Welcome to this 19-part series of Business Podcasts by David Maister, exploring the key principles and practices found in his new book, Strategy and the Fat Smoker.
Hello, I'm David Maister. In this series of podcasts, I'm proud to present a special 19-part series of the audiobook version of my new book, Strategy and the Fat Smoker. If you're interested in purchasing a copy of the book in hardback, it is now available from both Amazon.com and at my website at davidmaister.com/store. This is Chapter 11, A Great Coach in Action. The two previous podcasts explored some of the approaches that don't work in helping individuals and organizations stick to the diet and exercise program that will get them to their goals. In this episode, we will describe an approach that does work, ensuring that those in managerial roles have the attitude, skills, and behaviors of a skilled coach. I've told this story for many years and have referred to it briefly in my previous written work. This is the first time I've tried to capture in one place the many lessons from the story. When I first joined the Harvard Business School as an assistant professor, I was not full of self-confidence. In fact, I was sure that I was a hiring mistake. Rather than working at maximizing my performance, I focus on my immediate tasks, my teaching, and just try to do my job, hoping no one would look too closely at my capabilities and performance. For a while, this strategy worked. I was left alone. But after about 6 months, there was a knock at my office door. I opened it, and there stood one of my senior colleagues. "Hi, David," he said. "Have you got a minute for me?" "Sure," I mumbled. "It's such a pity that we don't have time to spend with each other," he said. "You have your responsibilities and I have mine, and they keep us busy. But I was just passing by and thought we might take a minute to catch up." "Tell me," he said, "what's your research about?" Since I wasn't doing any research, and we both knew that, I played for time. "Well, I've been very busy, and I'm not sure I'm really ready to commit, and there are a number of things that interest me," and on I unfolded my excuses. Eventually, as he remained silent, just listening, I said, "Well, maybe, just maybe, and I don't want to make any promises yet, perhaps professional firms would be interesting to study." He remained silent for a while and considered my answer. After what seemed an eternity, he spoke. "You know what, David? That's not a stupid choice. Now that you've mentioned the topic, I can't think of anything major that's been done on that subject. There's a real opportunity to do something important. What's more, nothing in an idea conflicts with what we want to do as a school. I'd tell you if it did. Well done, what a great idea." Then came the devastating follow-up question. "And what subjects do you plan to research about these firms?" I couldn't even pretend to have an answer. For perhaps the only time in my life, I was lost for words and remained silent. I'll never forget his next phrase until my dying day. He said, "I can see you haven't thought it through completely." "But," he continued, "I know people at some of these firms, and I hear a lot about the issues they have. Let me pass them on to you right now, in case one or more of those issues interest you." He proceeded to describe a range of managerial and strategic issues faced by such firms. Now, most people I discuss this with agree that at this point in the conversation, I had no choice but to select from among the options he described and say something like, "Well, I imagine it could be worthwhile to explore some of these topics with those firms." He went back into silent thought mode. Finally, he spoke again. "David, the more you talk about your plans, the more excited I get. This is great stuff. I can see it now. You'll do important work, get famous, and we'll all be very proud of you. Tell you what I'll do, David. I'll have my secretary come by and give you a type list of all the professional firm leaders that I know. Feel free to contact them and use my name. Tell them I suggested you call." He then looked at his watch and said, "I'm really sorry, David, but my duties call me away. I hope I'll be able to come by soon and see how things are going. I don't know when that might be, but sometime soon, I hope." And then he left. Within 10 minutes, just 10 minutes, his secretary was at my door with a type list of names, addresses, and telephone numbers of professional firm leaders. Again, I had the overwhelming feeling that I now had no choice. There was nothing I could do but call those people. They turned out to be interesting and helpful, and I was on my way. What turned out to be the thrill ride of a career had truly and finally been launched. And here's the point as I experienced it. If he had not shown up, I know that it would have taken me a long time to get organized and start investing in my career. I suffer from procrastination as much, if not more, than other people, and self-discipline has never been one of my strengths. It turned out, however, that with skilled coaching like this, I was capable of getting more done than I ever dreamed of, and could achieve a great deal more when coached well than I could when left to my own devices. So what were the lessons? When I tell this story in my seminars, I turn to the participants and ask, what was it about what he did and the way that he did it that made it so effective as a piece of coaching? How did he get this person, me, who was doing okay but really did not have the car in gear, to get going and start being productive? You may want to pause here and write down what you think the key elements were. The answers people give me are numerous, but almost always include the following. Most people who hear this story observe correctly that there was no debate in our meeting about whether or not I should be doing some research. That had been predetermined long before and was a precondition for his coaching to work. His sole task was to help me stay true to a prior agreement. There was real agreed-upon standards already in existence. The role of this is often poorly understood in professional firms. Standards in many firms are aspirations, not minimum behaviors. Without unambiguous, non-negotiable standards, coaching cannot work. Can you imagine the following conversation? Coach, I'm here to help you meet the standards. Recipient, I choose not to meet that standard at the moment. Coach, oh, okay, but let me try and persuade you anyway. The tragedy of many professional firms that this is exactly what happens in many coaching situations, particularly, for example, between and among so-called partners. I previously have talked about how a firm might achieve an unambiguous prior agreement on its standards. In this podcast, my discussion will continue as if your firm does indeed have such an agreement on standards. Now notice he was also enforcing the standards. Accepting that there were real standards at the Harvard Business School, when did he begin to enforce them? Most people would say the moment he knocked on my door. It was not only the conversation itself that sent the unavoidable message that the standards were real and enforced. Perhaps even more powerful was the fact that by his presence, he obviously A, had been paying attention, and B, was able to respond in real time to my, quotes, departure from excellence, end quote. The process of standards enforcement had already begun before he said a word. To this day, I remember both the feeling and the familiar phrase that went through my mind. Oh boy, around here you can run, but you can't hide. Of course, it's a common failing amongst professional firms that those in managerial positions do not notice issues early and do not have the time to respond to them in short order. Poor coaching is not a problem of bad will or bad attitude. It's often more often a matter of the managers not having the time to do it, or perhaps placing other things ahead of it in priority. It was important to stress that I was not, at least yet, failing or struggling. My colleague didn't wait to respond until I was, quotes, in trouble. He intervened whilst there was still time to help and influence me. Essential to his impact on me was the fact that he had, or had created, the time and inclination to discuss my weaknesses with me, one topic at a time, right when they first became evident. As simple as this preventative measure may seem, it is not that common or easy. Perhaps a majority of us in supervisory or managerial roles prefer to wait until the problem is so bad that we have to deal with it. After all, we have other things to do, and discussing with another person their weaknesses is not always our favorite activity. I have direct personal experience with this, like most of us. When I first set up my consulting business, I faced for the first time in my career the task of managing someone, my administrative assistant. I had at least two big problems in being a good manager. First, my assistant was basically terrific, so I felt that pointing out and discussing things that could have been done better was being demanding. And it is. That's the job of a manager. Second, because I did not feel confident about my interpersonal skills, I was not sure I could provide a constructive critique and get the reaction I wanted. What if instead of responding, she took offense and quit? As a result of these concerns, like many other managers, I decided to say and do nothing. After all, she was very good overall, wasn't she? Why rock the boat? I decided, like many of us, to save up all my critique and feedback for a full year and then give it to her all at once at performance review time, just like it said in the textbooks. Or so I thought they said. This meant I tried to give her feedback in one session on 17 different subjects, months after the events we're discussing had happened, right at the time when it would influence her pay. Can you imagine a process less likely to get someone to listen, accept, and respond? Yet it's how businesses and professional firms do it all the time. A performance discussion at compensation setting time is absolutely the worst time to get someone to engage with you, to acknowledge a performance issue, and to participate in designing a solution. By having the conversation at that time, you're asking them to put their income at risk. Even if they're aware of their weakness, they often cannot afford to acknowledge it at such a time because they probably need the money. Eventually, I learned the lesson we all have to learn. If I really wanted my assistant to improve, then the way to do it was the way it was done to me. Dropping by on a casual basis to discuss a single topic at a time, right when the weakness first became evident and when it had absolutely nothing to do with pay. I'm not saying I ever got truly good at it, but I did eventually understand what I should be trying to do. Another thing that people notice about what my colleague did is that it was informal and unscheduled. Anywhere in the world, whenever I've discussed the story, there is almost universal agreement that one key to the successful impact was that it was informal and unscheduled. Most people agree that informal interactions have been most influential in their own development. Very few people attribute much influence, if any, to the formal processes they experience, such as annual performance reviews, counseling sessions, or even training programs. Think about your own development. Did those things really influence your development? One of the eternal mysteries of management is that although we all know what worked on us, we keep putting in place other things, such as formal systems, for other people, for them. The truth is that all formal, scheduled performance appraisal processes are doomed to failure. See, for example, a good book called Abolishing Performance Appraisals, Why They Backfire and What to Do Instead, written by Tom Coanes and Mary Jenkins for a similar and more detailed view. Performance appraisal systems in both large and small firms may serve to help arrive at compensation decisions, meet statutory and regulatory requirements for human resource management, or fulfill a host of other purposes. What they never do is cause performance to rise. We've all lived through this. Only personal attention and coaching really help us or other people develop. Something else pointed out is that he talked about me and only me. Most people hearing my story remarked that my senior colleague barely referred to the organization to which we both belonged. He did not make appeals to my sense of responsibility or duty, such as, "These are our performance expectations here, David. Let me remind you of your obligations." For that matter, he didn't talk about himself, his expectations, his reactions to my performance. He didn't say, "I'm a little disappointed in you, David." He didn't talk about anything at all, except me. The entire conversation was focused on me, which of course made it completely fascinating. He focused exclusively on helping me find what was interesting to me, not what was interesting to him or what was needed by the institution. Many managers think they have influence when they talk about what we are trying to accomplish, where our firm is going, and what the world expects of us. All of this can be valid, but it ignores a profound human truth. The most fascinating topic for most human beings is themselves. Apparently, I'm not the only egocentric person in the world. Talk to me about me and you have my full attention. Talk to me about anything else and the odds that I will engage go down dramatically. His approach was guided by a simple insight. If people set goals for themselves, guided by their own true interests, they're much more likely to pursue those goals with passion and to actually accomplish them than if you give them goals or attempt to tell them what they should become interested in. If I tell you what my goals are, I inevitably give you nagging rights. You can ask me about my progress toward my goals. You can ask me about them without offending me. You have the right to manage me more and manage me more frequently. However, if you try to get me to pursue your goals and not mine, then every time you ask me about progress towards your goals, I will feel resentment and less will get done. The point is meant to be a practical one, not a moral one. It just means that the coach will in fact get better results for the institution if he or she finds out what the person is capable of being passionate about, and then finds a way to make that work for the institution. That way, everybody wins. Of course, if the person is passionate about nothing or cares for things that don't help the institution, then the coach's task is clear. Urgently and actively help the person leave the organization and pursue his or her passion, or lack of it, elsewhere. My coach asked questions encouraging me to choose my own goals, but it should be equally clear that I was not going to get out of that meeting without choosing something. There was indeed an iron will beneath that courteous exterior. Not only was the conversation about me, but my colleague achieved an amazing feat. He actually made me believe that he was interested in me personally. He seemed to care, at least a little, about me as a person. I invite you to reflect at this point on your own reactions. Would it matter to you if someone trying to counsel and coach you convinced you that he or she was interested in and cared about you? Would it matter to you? Would it make a difference? Ask the same question in reverse. If you doubted someone's interest in and care for you, would that impact that person's influence on you? I'm bold enough to predict your answer. Yes, a person's impact on me does depend on what I believe to be his or her level of interest in me. An interesting question arises. Can someone fake interest and still convince you that they care about you? Can they make you think they are interested in you by learning the right skills, words, and behaviors, or do they actually have to care? Answer the question from your own experience. How readily do you think you can tell if someone's trying to make you think they care when they really do not? I can guess at your answer, but I know mine. You can perhaps fool me once, but not a second time. In the Trusted Advisor book, my co-authors and I explored this same topic in the context of dealing with clients, and I discussed it earlier in this series in the chapter called Do You Really Want Relationships? It turns out that the issues in dealing with clients are very similar to the issues when you're talking about it in a managerial context. As human beings, we accept the influence mostly, if not exclusively, of those we trust. And our trust is earned by true trustworthiness, not technique. Unfortunately, most managers, when conducting managerial and coaching conversations, fail to convince the other person that they are truly interested in the person they're coaching. Very often, because they're not. Notice, at no time did my colleague say anything negative about me. He did not criticize me, even though a critique would have been fair and valid. David, you're not doing any research, and it's expected around here. Your teaching may be improving, but you're not one of the best yet. Why did he not criticize me? Was it because he was such a nice person? No, perhaps. But I think he refrained from it because he understood one of the primary truths about human beings, which is that absolutely the worst way to get somebody to acknowledge and correct a weakness is to criticize him or her. As human beings, we have a built-in reflex. Criticize me and I will defend myself, whether what you say is valid or invalid, fair or unfair. Later in our relationship, I did ask my colleague why he had never actually voiced any critiques and why he had led me to form my own conclusions about what he was implying, but never actually stated. I learned long ago, David, he said, that if two people both know something is true, there's not much point saying it out loud. He continued, there are better ways to get your point across. The key task is to create a way that the other person can concede the point without losing face. It's not easy to learn and not easy to do, but it almost never includes explicitly criticizing the other person. Notice he actually helped me. Many people comment that it must have been very motivating for my colleague to substantively help me, providing leads and contacts in order to get me started. It was. I've worked with many people around the world for decades, and I frequently ask, how many of you think that your manager, coach, or supervisor actually helps you succeed as opposed to demanding that you do? The proportions are depressingly low, as small as 10% sometimes. Yet consider the psychology of it. If someone's just asked you what you want to achieve and has taken the first step to help you get there, wouldn't you feel an overwhelming obligation to take the next step? For more on this psychological principle, see Robert Cialdini's book, Influence. The lesson for managers, coaches, and supervisors, all synonymous terms as far as I am concerned, is obvious. If you want somebody to respond to you, you must first find out what they want and help them towards that goal. Every time you plan to meet with someone to give advice, counsel, or direction, ask yourself, do I know how I'm going to help this person in a way that he or she would consider substantive help? If the answer is no, then you're not ready for the meeting. The next point is that he focused on the first doable steps, not the total journey. Many people point out that my senior colleague did not focus on the ultimate achievement or the goal, you, David, need to write a book, but on small, carefully chosen, doable first steps. Do you think you could call these 7 people? As obvious this is, most of us break this rule all the time. We try to get people energized and motivating by set us performance standards and then turning the person loose for a year. Here's the world record, go! Instead, tempting someone onto the improvement path often requires that you remain completely silent about the full task ahead and just focus on immediate small improvements. In fact, that's what good coaches do in all walks of life. Coaches working with high-achieving athletes focus on one task at a time, reaching for small improvements in each area. They don't raise the bar in large increments. They increase it slowly and help the person make cumulative, repeated improvements. That's how you help someone become a world beater. He also gave me confidence. In another recent article of mine called Management, What It Really Takes, which you can find on my website, davidmaester.com, I stress that you can't really help someone improve until you figure out why that person is underperforming. In my case, surprising to those who know me now, my problem was I was not sure I could do research and writing. My colleague's explicit and implicit confidence that I could pull this off, remove what for me, and I'm told in discussions worldwide for many people, a major roadblock to accomplishment. He also kept his word. He did what he said he was going to do, and he did it incredibly quickly. Because he kept his word promptly, I too was spurred into action. It would be almost impolite to fail to follow through with the list he provided. Further, the cultural precedent had been set. Around here, you do what you say you're going to do. The message is clear. If you want your people to live up to their commitments and obligations, then you must first live up to yours. People will never live up to higher standards than their manager exhibits. Some last thoughts about this simple little story. The story confirms lessons that others have recognized and written about. Dale Carnegie's 1936 book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, remains the gold standard for learning how to interact with other people. Blanchard and Johnson's The 1 Minute Manager is a fabulous place to start for those who are completely new to thinking about all this. And Peter Friedis's book, The 2R Manager, details exactly what a manager can say and do to be effective. But there remains the fat smoker mystery. If so many people have offered such practical wisdom on being a manager, and their work has been so well disseminated, publicized, and understood, why do so many managers, including me, fail to apply all of this practical wisdom? It's instructive to note that many of us frequently do apply the lessons and approaches described above, but we tend to use them more often in our personal lives than in our work lives. When dealing with family or those in our community, we are more likely to be informal, questioning, helpful, use the language of suggestion, and offer our confidence-building support. However, we tend to restrict these habits to our personal lives without transferring them to the business world. When we care, we do things in a coaching fashion. When we don't, we don't. And in either case, we get back what we deserve. This concludes this chapter of my book, Strategy and the Fat Smoker. If you're interested in ordering a copy of the book in its printed form, visit Amazon.com or my website at davidmaester.com/store.